Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is a defining moment for the Republican Party. If our answer to the fastest growing demographic in this country is that we want to make felons of your grandparents and we want to put people in jail who are helping your neighbors and people related to you, then we're going to suffer mightily. Let's don't filibuster. Let's solve the problem in a comprehensive way.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News Sunday yesterday, and someone in the Republican Party must have thought it was a good idea to pick a big fight over immigration going into the 2006 elections. I wonder if they are regretting it. In any case, Majority Leader Bill Frist plans to bring this all to a head this week, all these competing visions of illegal immigrants as felons or guest workers or future citizens. That Senate debate was already in full swing on the Sunday morning talk shows. Here are Virginia's George Allen and Barack Obama of Illinois.
I do agree mostly with the Corn and Kyle approach, which over a period of time, if somebody wants to become a legal citizen, they're going to have to return to their home country. And it may be over the next 3, 4, 5 years, but then they're going to have to enter legally.
Nobody who makes these proposals has explained to me a realistic mechanism whereby we're going to ship 11 to 12 million people out of the country.
The Republican Allen and the Democrat Obama both spoke on ABC's This Week. We begin the week, as we usually do, talking Monday morning politics, this time with much of our focus on that turning point for the GOP that Senator Graham was talking about, with Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard and one of the co-hosts of the Fox News Channel's Beltway Boys, and a staunch supporter of President Bush, as documented in a new book called Rebel in Chief, which compares President Bush to Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt for being a big ideas visionary, not always understood in his time. Fred also wrote that Wall Street Journal op-ed piece that we talked about some last week, calling on President Bush to appoint Dick Cheney, defense secretary, and move Condoleezza Rice to vice president. Fred, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
I'm glad to be on. Those were not exactly recommendations. They were the kind of things that I was suggesting the president could do if he really wanted to make give his entire administration a dramatic facelift. So far, he started merely by changing his White House chief of staff. I think he needs to do a bit more.
Do you have any indication that the president is seriously considering, those particular items? I mean, you made a pretty strong case mm-hmm. for Condoleezza Rice as vice president as a historic and political coup.
Well, it would. What would be it be behind that would be the president's desire to really anoint a successor. Now, so far, he hasn't shown any desire to anoint a successor, but if he did, there would be one of he'd have to choose one of three people, either his brother, Jeb Bush, the Florida governor.
Can't do that.
He seems, does America want another Bush right away? I doubt it, and Jeb doesn't want to run anyway. He could pick Dick Cheney, the vice president, who I've talked to many, many times about running in 2008, and I've never heard a guy more down on the idea than he is. And he's not very popular at the moment anyway. That leaves Condoleezza Rice. So if you really wanted to anoint a successor, how would you anoint her? You would make her vice president. And obviously that job is held at the moment, so you'd have to get Dick Cheney to move on to something else or just become a counselor at the White House. I suggested defense secretary. It's a job he had before in the first Bush administration, Bush the Elder's administration. I think he would fit right in there, but there are other things he could do. Or, knowing Dick Cheney, he'd probably be happy to do nothing right about now.
Well, you're not the only one suggesting that maybe there should be an opening at the top of the Pentagon. Here is retired General Anthony Zinni speaking on Meet the Press yesterday.
Should someone resign?
Absolutely.
Who?
Secretary of Defense, to begin with.
Anyone else?
Well, I think those that have been responsible for the planning, for overriding all the efforts that were made in planning before that those that stood by and allowed this to happen, that didn't speak out, and there are appropriate ways within the system you can speak out at congressional hearings and otherwise, I think they have to be held accountable.
Now, General Zinni, I guess we could say, isn't exactly Howard Dean. So how does it strike you when he calls for the resignation of Rumsfeld?
Yeah, he's not exactly President Bush either, or a supporter of the war in Iraq from the beginning. I don't agree with him, but I do accept in the Rumsfeld case, except that I do think all officials ought to be held accountable. I think they pretty much have been. That doesn't mean they have to be fired, however.
By the way, would it just on the rice idea, mm-hmm. would it be right in our democracy to switch vice presidents like that? It's an elected position, and mm-hmm. it's one thing if the elected vice president can no longer serve for one reason. Mm-hmm. Is it another if the president just feels like making a change?
Well, we see these things all the time. I mean, was it right for James Jeffords of Vermont, elected as a Republican, as a part of the Republican, then making a Republican majority when you added in the vice president's vote, was it right for him to switch and caucus with the Democrats and switch control of the Senate? I think he was perfectly, that was perfectly appropriate given his own thinking and feeling about the Republican Party, and I think this would be all right, too. Unusual, but okay.
Okay, on to immigration. Do you agree with Senator Graham that immigration makes this week a defining moment for the Republican Party?
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, but I do think it's a very important moment for the Republican Party, and they are, to some extent, deciding what kind of party they want to be. Do they want to be the party of Ronald Reagan, a party of openness, or do they want to be the party of Pat Buchanan and a party of exclusivity? And I think that's a pretty easy choice, though many, many people in the Republican Party seem to want to go the way of exclusivity and have this cramped view of America and immigrants. Do you want to be pro-immigrant or anti-immigrant? I think you have to be, if you want to have a growing party, you need to be pro-immigrant.
Is this pro-immigrant stance part of the conservatism of the future that you write about in your book?
Well, I think it should be, although a lot of conservatives seem to be resisting it, don't they? An awful lot of them, in fact, an awful lot of them, particularly in the House of Representatives in Washington, seem to have this this narrow, cramped vision of America that can't that is being somehow its culture and its politics are being damaged somehow by too many immigrants coming in the country. I think just the opposite. I think immigrants are a blessing for America, and we ought to. It's fine, though, however, to find a way that we can organize and legalize immigration in this country. But we do need a lot of immigrants, not just for economic reasons, though we do need them for that too. But they refresh our country. We are a country of immigrants. There has never been a wave of immigrants into America that didn't help America, that didn't make America a better place. You know, the argument I hear that I hate the most is when they say, well, these immigrants now, these people coming from Mexico, they don't want to be Americans and they don't want to assimilate. Well, I sure know a heck of a lot of them, and particularly from Central America. And I think all the ones I know, and I know dozens, all want to become Americans, and they all want to assimilate. And if they have trouble doing it, their children have no trouble at all.
Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard, my guest on WNYC. His new book about President Bush is called Rebel in Chief. It is amazing how this issue splits both parties. We had an AFL-CIO official mm-hmm. here last week publicly parting ways with Ted Kennedy on the issue because of low wages. And on the Republican side, we have maybe you'd call it cultural conservatives and small local government conservatives splitting with Wall Street Journal free market conservatives mm-hmm. and demographic realist Republican Party leaders. Is peace possible between these camps within the Republican Party, or does one camp or the other have to prevail?
Well, I think peace will probably be a little easier in the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, but we're going to come to a moment very soon here, Brian, where after the Senate passes a bill, and I think they're going to pass a bill, it certainly looks like it anyway this week, that will have not only stepped up border enforcement, but also a guest worker program, and also a path whereby the 11 or 12 million illegal immigrants in the country now can earn their way to citizenship. So
basically,
have all three things.
Mm-hmm, so basically, you think the Kennedy-McCain bill is going to pass?
Yes. And or something like it. I mean, the key provision that they've adopted from the Kennedy-McCain bill is the earned citizenship. And, you know, you do it through, you learn English, you pay any back taxes, you hold a job, you have a job and hold a job and so on. It would still take a minimum of 11 years before you could become a citizen. But anyway, I suspect that'll pass the Senate. The House has its border enforcement only bill. And there will be a conference of the House and the Senate, and that's when we'll have the real crunch time. That's when President Bush, I believe, is going to get much more involved. It's important for President Bush, though, not just to get involved privately in lobbying and having his people lobby and push and so on inside a conference, which is not a public event, but I think he needs to do it publicly as well. He's done a little bit, but not much. He really needs to convince the Republican faithful and the rest of the country as well that a bill that not only secures the border, but has a way for immigrants here in the country to become citizens, that that's the best thing for America.
In that Lindsey Graham clip we played, he said, let's don't filibuster. Do you see a filibuster as a possibility, and if so, by whom?
The only person who's talked about a filibuster was Harry Reid, and said that he would consider, or even he might have gone farther than that. But anyway, he was talking about a filibuster of an enforcement-only bill. In other words, if the conference couldn't agree on anything but border enforcement, and that came back to the Senate, that he might lead a filibuster. I don't know.
And he's the Democratic leader, of course.
He is the Democratic leader in the Senate, and I'm not sure whether they could pull one off or not.
You know, it's funny how immigration plays differently in different parts of the country. Here in New York, we have, of course, many, many, many immigrants, and more than half the city now, immigrant or children of immigrants, and yet there isn't the intent. There's, you know, plenty of strong feelings on many sides, but there is not the anti-immigrant fervor in the concentration that you find along the Southwest. And I think it's for many reasons, but I wonder what you think about that. And what do you say to the people in the Southwest who might have heard your earlier answer about how immigrants always help this country, and think, well, that may be true in the long run and in the national sense, but my community is so stressed by an overwhelming number of immigrants, many of them illegal, that it's raising my property taxes and, you know, putting all these other stresses on schools and other things in the community.
Well, I think we have to be sympathetic to them, and there may be a role for the federal government to step in and aid those communities which have been swamped, and certainly there are a lot of them, particularly in Arizona and California, probably a lesser extent in Texas, which has had an enormous amount of immigration over the years. Anyway, I think you have to be sympathetic to them. I don't think you can ram a bill down the throats of so many people who object to immigration, a bill that says the people here who came here illegally can become citizens, and we're going to have all these people come in and work, 400 or 1,000 or so guest workers, and I think you have to convince them. That's where I think the president has a big role, and also members of Congress, to really speak out and explain and educate the country on this subject and promise some relief to these communities that really have been swamped. I mean, they're not making it up.
Is this divide that we see in the Republican Party over this issue a reflection of varied interests that individuals have, individual politicians, in the 2006 congressional elections or in the presidential campaigns?
Well, it's not much of an issue. I mean, the presidential campaign, let me start with that, reflects it a little bit. Obviously, McCain, and we heard George Allen, the senator from Virginia, a few minutes ago, you played a bite from him. They're not in the same place. McCain would not force anyone to return to their home country to get in line there to become a citizen in the United States, and Allen would. That's the bill sponsored by Senator John Cornyn of Texas and Kyle of
Arizona. So why do they each think? I mean, even, you know, the fact that McCain is on one side of that and Kyle is on the other side of that, they're the senators from the same state.
They are.
Are they doing the same politics and coming up with different numbers?
Well, they're doing the same politics and coming up with different bills, that's for sure. I don't know about the numbers. The Arizona, remember, passed, was it in 2004, must have been a very restrictive referendum that limits what sort of public services illegal immigrants can get. And there's a strong anti-immigrant feeling in Arizona, but it doesn't seem to have hurt John McCain's popularity at all. So the politics there are unusual. You know, remember, who did Republicans elect just a month or so ago as their new leader, a majority leader in the House of Representatives? John Boehner of Ohio, who voted against the enforcement-only bill. So while the politics of immigration seem to be furious right now, they don't affect everything.
We'll continue with Fred Barnes in a minute, talking about Iraq, FEMA, other things. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Neither party should be defined by pandering to the outer reaches of American politics and the agents of intolerance, whether they be Louis Farrakhan or Al Sharpton on the left, or Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell on the right.
So that's what John McCain has said previously about Jerry Falwell. Now he's planning to give the commencement address at Falwell's Liberty University. And here's what he said about that on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
I believe that the Christian right has a major role to play in the Republican Party. One reason is because they're so active in their followers are, and I believe they have a right to be a part of our party. I don't have to agree with everything they stand for, nor do I have to agree with everything that's on the liberal side of the Republican Party.
And with that, we continue talking Monday Morning Politics, this week mostly about intra-Republican politics with Fred Barnes, editor of the Weekly Standard, one of the Fox News Channel's Beltway Boys, with Morton Kondracki, and author of the new book, Casting the Bush Presidency in a Transformative Historical Light, called Rebel in Chief, published by Crown Point. Fred, are you a John McCain fan?
Well, I never have been, but he's been very great on the war, I'll have to say. He's been terrific in supporting President Bush on the war, and he was very active in 2004, and now obviously he's running for president in 2008 and is aggressively courting people he criticized heavily before. It's a flip-flop, understandable in light of his aspirations.
So the two clips that we just played, you just call it a flip-flop, plain and simple.
Yeah, sure.
For political purposes.
Well, it's an understandable flip-flop. We see a lot of him in politics. He was trashing Falwell famously, of course, in 2000 along with Pat Robertson, and he did it in Virginia, the state in which they both live. Not that they're terribly popular people, but I think a lot of Christians just took it as a rejection of them. And it was a mistake, a political mistake, as McCain is obviously reflecting now. The other thing he's doing, tomorrow, I think it's tomorrow, maybe it's today, mm-hmm. He's going to be in College Station, Texas, giving a speech at Texas A&M, a speech hosted by the elder George Bush, the former president.
Mm-hmm.
He is really making tremendous efforts to woo Bush people and Bush voters. And
at that straw poll, Republican straw poll event recently, he actually put his name on the informal ballot as George Bush instead of John McCain.
Yeah, he urged people to vote for Bush. Even when he had the McCain and Bush votes, they wouldn't have won, but it was a Frist event. I mean, half the people there were from Tennessee, so
right.
It was a Bill Frist event. I think McCain, he's the front runner. Republicans usually nominate the next guy in line. He's the next guy in line after George Bush, who's president now. So I think he's off to a pretty good start.
On this flip-flop and mm-hmm. suddenly cultivating the president when, yes, as you say, he's been a strong supporter of his on the war, but not always on other things. If part of McCain's appeal to the center, what David Brooks calls the McCain-Lieberman Party,
mm-hmm.
was of someone who marched to his own drummer rather than a party line, does he risk that with these recent actions?
Of course he does. I mean, he still does many, many things that infuriate conservatives in the Bush White House and the Weekly Standard and so on, or at least me. But he has to do something to win over the majority in the Republican Party, and a lot of these people are active Christians, and many, many of them are obviously Bush supporters. These are things he has to do, and there'll be plenty of other things that you think of as being things that only John McCain would do, marching to his own drummer. But it's a tightrope.
Speaking of active Christians, I want to play a clip from NPR's All Things Considered yesterday. This is Richard Cizik. He's vice president mm-hmm. for policy of the National Association of Evangelicals. And he is talking here about evangelicals first as great internationalists, but now more of them coming to question the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
There is an expression. It goes like this. As evangelicals go, so goes the West. And thus, if evangelicals decide that this isn't worth it, if the cost is greater than the benefit to be achieved, then I would say yes, the president's support among evangelicals for this war will evaporate. It's that serious.
So Fred Barnes, he seems to be implying at least that evangelicals are on the verge of deciding that it's not been worth it.
I'm not sure Rich is a spokesman for evangelicals. I know a ton of them. I'm one myself, and I haven't sensed that, except in the way that the American people more broadly are wondering now whether the war was worth it or not. Well, we see it reflected in public opinion polls. I don't think it's particularly affected evangelicals, probably less among them than other groups, because they tend to be more conservative and more pro-Bush.
Some of that was inspired by the Afghan apostasy case, the possible death sentence for mm-hmm. that guy who converted to Christianity.
Right.
Do you think that even the evangelical right is coming to doubt the military war on terror, or if they are, in a different way than some other Americans?
Well, they certainly wonder about Afghanistan in light of the what was his name, Rahman case. And I was certainly alarmed by it, as I think many Christians were, and everyone else was, for that matter. You wonder, well, look, if they're going to be persecuting people for their religious beliefs, doesn't that clash with the reason why we freed that country in the first place? And of course it does. And the Bush administration, it didn't just happen accidentally or in the course of events that the guy was finally released. It was the Bush administration, from President Bush on down, including Condi Rice and so on, did everything they could to make sure that guy was not tried, convicted, and executed. But there are going to be other cases. This is going to be a persistent problem where in Muslim countries, including Afghanistan, which is the only one other than Iraq that we freed, but where Christians are persecuted.
I think the biggest thing you credit the president with in your book is putting global democracy at the heart of his foreign policy.
Yes.
But does he, and do other Republicans, have the stomach for an elected Hamas and now perhaps an elected pro-Iran Jafri Muqtada Assad or Iraq as being either in the U.S. interest or inherently right because it's democracy, even if they're not in the U.S. interest?
Well, no, I don't think you do have a stomach for that. And they're not inherently right. Democracies can make mistakes. In the long run, they produce governments that do not go to war with their neighbors and are better for their own people. You worry about a government like an elected government like Hamas, whether if there were another election in a couple of years, whether they would allow themselves to be voted out of power. That's what you don't want, you know, one election, one time. And look, the Bush administration is working very strongly against the creation of a government of Jafri and Sadr.
That's why Rice and Jack Straw are there today.
Well, that's one of the reasons they're there. But they this is the what Zal Khalidzad, the American ambassador over there, is you know, breaking arms to get to make sure we don't wind up with a government like that, and not only because Sadr would be a part of it, which is bad enough, but because Jafri's a weak leader. There's a strong belief that there are other, you know, maybe 3, 4, or 5 people who would be all of them Shia, who would be strong leaders, and Jafri certainly isn't one of them.
By the way, did you read this little item in the Washington Post that during the flight to Baghdad on Secretary Rice's jet, she gave Straw the bed in her cabin, and she slept on the floor in the aisle? Isn't it supposed to be the other way around?
I thought the gentleman was supposed to give. I hadn't read that, but I guess she really wants Jack Straw on her side.
I guess so. Well, now she's the gentleman. Mm-hmm. Fred Barnes, my guest on WNYC, executive editor of the Weekly Standard, co-host of Fox News Channel's The Beltway Boys, and author of a new book now, a laudatory about President Bush called Rebel in Chief. In a way, it was easier in the past when our enemies were Nazis and communists because they were almost never democracies, with a few unfortunate exceptions. But if the Iraqi people chose the parliament in the election that certainly you label historic in the book, and the elected majority sends Iraq on this Islamist Shiite death squad pro-Iran path, if that's what they're doing, does that present a new kind of policy challenge for the United States that we don't have any history to draw on?
It would if that were happening, but that, of course, is not what what's happening over there. Obviously, there's some sectarian strife and some killings. There have been that. It's not a civil war by a long shot, and most of the mullahs are not at least the Shiite clerics in Iraq are not countenancing killings or death squads or retribution against the Sunnis or anything like that. And so you remember when the Shiites got together, I think Jafri won the endorsement by one vote. And a lot of those votes came from the Sadr faction. And so he's beholden to Sadr. I think it's going to be worked out. At least I hope so. And I've been assured by members of the administration, not that they can guarantee anything, that they will wind up with a government, and soon, that does not have Joffrey at the head or Sadr in any sort of pivotal position.
Really? You feel you've been assured that?
I've been assured that, but the people are assuring me they can't guarantee it. They're operating on the basis of some information and a lot of hope.
Is it the U.S.'s place? Some people say, look, we are touting this democracy that we've helped to establish in Iraq, and then as soon as they elect a prime minister that we don't like, Rice and Straw go there and whack them out of power.
Well, they're not going to whack them out of power. They haven't formed a government yet, but you have a huge other faction. You have the more secular faction, you have the Kurds, and of course you have the Sunnis. And everyone says they want to have a unity government, but can you have a unity government with Joffrey at the head? Probably not. The U.S.'s are pushing for what they say they want, and I'm all for the pushing.
Yeah, and again, on our theme of turning points for the Republican Party these days, I want to read to you, you've probably seen it, this is from today's Wall Street Journal op-ed page, the piece by Wilmar Gerecht from the American Enterprise Institute. Certainly not Howard Dean in his case.
No, not at all. And a wonderful analyst of everything in the Middle East.
So I'm going to read a few little excerpts of this for you and our listeners.
Sure.
And he writes, though the Bush administration hates to admit it, daily life in Baghdad has become worse. For those politically active, life is more dangerous now than ever. It is irrelevant whether small businesses, imports, and school and hospital construction, the famous school construction that supporters of the war I was talking about, are doing better if Iraq's political and intellectual classes, not to mention foreigners who are trying to help them, cannot walk out of their homes unguarded. If Baghdad remains a killing zone where Iraq's leaders can safely gather only under U.S. protection, then the prognosis for the Iraqi national identity, which has always had Baghdad at its center, is poor. That's worrisome stuff.
It is worrisome stuff, and if somebody else had written that or said that, I'd be distrustful of it. But I know Ruel, and so I believe it, and it's clear. You know, when General Casey was here in town the other day, and last week he spoke to the Bush cabinet, and as he pointed out, it's only a small part of Iraq where the violence is concentrated, but unfortunately that small part is Baghdad.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, you know, the rest of the country's fine, but, you know, when the center of your country, your capital, your intellectual, government, military, everything, the center of everything is, as Ruel describes, that's a problem. That's a huge problem, and you really can't create a stable democracy as long as anything like that exists.
Let me go on a little bit more from that piece, speaking about the rest of the country, or part of it anyway. He says, within a year, at most two, Iraq could become Algeria. Regions of southern Iraq appear to be increasingly under the sway of Tehran. Iran will try to prevent the birth of functioning democracy backed by senior Iraqi clerics who don't recognize the legitimacy of theocracy. That's that the Bush administration would welcome Syria-backed Iranian-U.S. talks in Baghdad is bizarre. We should want to underscore and oppose all of Syria's Iranian flirtations, he writes. And then finally says, Washington currently has no Shiite partner in Iraq. In all probability, it will not find one.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but it's being written by somebody who's certainly sympathetic to the creation of a stable Iraq. Look, it's hard creating a democracy. It's harder than I think people in the Bush administration thought it would be. It's harder than I thought it would be, for what that's worth, not much, I'm afraid. But it's and seems to get right now seems to be getting more difficult every day. But so there really is a sense of urgency inside the Bush administration to get a unity government formed as quickly as possible, one that obviously includes Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia, and as well, even though, as I pointed out earlier, even though I hear voices of optimism about that happening from inside the administration, you don't seem to see anything on the ground to indicate that that's going to happen anytime soon.
Another view of this as a turning point for Republicans and conservatives comes in the review of your book in the New York Times Book Review. I know you're going to say it's the New York Times Book Review.
Well, I didn't read it, but...
Well, they jointly reviewed your book and the new book, Imposter, by Bruce Bartlett from the Reagan and Bush 41 administrations. Mm-hmm. Bartlett sees the president as what he calls a pretend conservative, really a partisan Republican willing to jettison conservative principles at a moment's notice to achieve more success for the party. That's, quote, on the deficit especially, but in general, Bartlett sees the president as disdainful of serious research-based policy analysis. Mm-hmm. So what is there a difference between a Bruce Bartlett conservative and a Fred Barnes conservative?
Well, certainly in our view of Bush, I've known Bruce for 25 years, and he's a friend of mine. We disagree on Bush. I mean, Bush is a conservative. I mean, look at his, look at his record. I mean, and the things he ran on. Some, you know, cutting taxes. He's certainly a Social Security, a social conservative rather.
A Social Security conservative.
Well, he tried to reform Social Security, a very bold and conservative initiative that failed in 2005. But whether it's on social issues of abortion or cloning or stem cell research or anything, he's a conservative on economic issues, certainly in cutting taxes and holding to that.
What about the deficit?
And the deficit, I'll tell you where George Bush is on the deficit. He's in the same place Ronald Reagan was. Ronald Reagan was for economic growth first, and worrying about the deficit second. And, of course, the deficits are much smaller as a part of GDP under Bush than they are under Reagan. Where Bush, Bruce gets this idea that somehow the Bush is leading the country to economic ruin, I think, is I certainly don't see it. I don't know any serious, at least conservative economists who see it, and I think it's kind of silly. Where Bush makes conservatives mad is on, well, one of the issues we just started talking about in the beginning, Brian, and that's immigration. He's a liberal on immigration. He is for letting, defining a way for illegal immigrants here to become American citizens. And then and the other one, of course, is the issue of government, the size of government. Bush looks out, I think he does anyway, he hadn't told me this, but I assume he does, he looks out and sees a federal government that Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich and many other conservatives tried to reduce in size and scope for the last 50 years, and they failed. And they failed because the American people demand a lot of the federal government and want a large one. And his idea, as I interpret it anyway, Bush's idea is to use this large government for conservative ends, mm-hmm. and not trying to worry about eliminating large departments because you're not going to achieve it.
We have a minute left. I want to try to touch two things real quickly. Mm-hmm. One is New York Times had a front page story yesterday about how they can't find a new head for FEMA because everybody sees the job as politically toxic. Which is, you know, considering the role of FEMA in the country at this point, how could it be?
Well, they'll find somebody. I wouldn't worry about that. Obviously, it was somewhat of a mistake putting all these agencies together in one department, and Bush was wrong about it. So were Democrats. I wish they hadn't. I was against it at the time.
And on Sandra Day O'Connor's speech this past month, I'm sure you've heard about it.
Yeah, the one where attacking Republican critics of the court.
Where she actually warned about the beginnings of dictatorship.
Oh, jeez.
Your reaction?
Nonsense. As John Riggins said, lighten up.
Senator John Cornyn said this, drawing a reaction. Oh, no, okay, we don't have time. Well, here's Senator Cornyn.
I wonder whether there may be some connection between the perception in some quarters on some occasions where judges are making political decisions yet are unaccountable to the public, that it builds up and builds up and builds up to the point where some people engage in violence.
Well, that was a huge mistake on Senator Cornyn's part,
right.
I believe, and
Fred
I
Barnes,
think he retracted that statement.
Fred Barnes, editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard, his new book called Rebel in Chief. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.